那种都看就为接续了什么下去了接续还是接续了什么名字
in the prasangika system a subsequent cognizer and a pramana a valid cognizer or sorry a prime cognizer let's see it is possible for a subsequent cognizer to be a prime cognizer
当什么什么什么什么对不？搞啥？解释的什么概念？什么概念写的？解释了呀，都是那个什么意思？我搞写不来。看底下，我底下的，底下他都是那个什么？那什么了呀？啥都没逻辑搞的写的，什么了呀
？But in the
什么了？搞啥？什么了呀？啥都没逻辑搞的，那么现在他都是那个什么？什么没写的
？But in the other systems such as Chittamatra, they say that a subsequent cognizer cannot be a prime cognizer because they interpret prime cognizer to be a new incontrovertible knower.
And the lekjana pramana sajarwa deo kasore tangoda zoliya jilu ni shevre.
This is the difference comes because the Sanskrit word pramana, the syllable pra, can be interpreted as meaning either new or main.
So, to say, then, do Kalanginza, the Ranshi Yubati, Chernam Gazan, Gazan, Rangatini Yubi Ranshi, Kalamin, Duzane, Ranshi Telemiluj, that's Hannah Doctor Jayun, Ranshi Telemiluj, Goratoni.
And the reason why they interpret pramana as being a new incontrovertible knower is that in those systems they feel that when objects imputed are analyzed there is something that can be found which is those objects.
Can you look at the church hanging there? 大顿在呢，你的露宿钱呢？叫我们把人都什么时候的？几点养着哩呀？几点养着的？他他年投诉的对呢？什么下用过的？这些用的几点呢？啥都露米露他年没去吧？露米露他年什么下用过吧？这都啥样子？人都蹲在露里呀？啥都啥都不过米露，实际上个米露也是过的。这用的解释来米露啥用的？
汤不得看，
汤不得看，汤不得。听见了的？小康人呢？大顿在呢？你的露宿没把人都？
But in the prasangika system, the view is that no phenomenon can be found when sought under analysis. Therefore, a pramana, a valid cognizer, is not something which can be found under analysis. Thus, they follow the conventions of the world and interpret the term as meaning a valid cognizer and not a new valid cognizer, since the world doesn't pay any attention with respect to pramana on whether the consciousness is new or not, only whether it is valid or not. Then within subsequent cognizers, there are several subdivisions. Then there are wrong consciousnesses which perversely know their objects. And there are two types, conceptual and non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses. Then there's doubt, which is a mental factor which has wavering or suspicion in two directions with respect to its object. Then in the Sakrantic system, the difference between a directly perceiving consciousness and a conceptually perceiving consciousness is that the first takes as its appearing object a specifically characterized phenomenon, whereas the latter takes as its appearing object a generally characterized phenomenon.
Andisha. To the comment that I share, Mare. That you look damn it, Andisha.
There are different interpretations on this topic.
That in it. That's all the Muslims, Jenny. Then a big shabbat double pleasure. No, because all day. Muslim day. That you've been a soup double. Then a you've been a tongue in the day. Muslim day. They think it kept that tongue. You could direct the game. You are. They think it kept that tongue. You are. Ne mangit. Ne go yamare. That they think it midagwata. They think it shabbata. Or that you engine, big shabbata. Kizzy kizzy, jiggle or sobe.
A directly perceiving consciousness is such that all of the factors that are together with its object, such as a flower, appear to that consciousness. Its impermanence, its productness, its momentary disintegration, and so forth. All of these appear to the consciousness, but are not necessarily noticed. So all of these attributes appear. However, a conceptual consciousness, when it conceives of the flower, for instance, puts aside all of these many attributes and just zeroes in on one factor.
Now when
a non-conceptual consciousness such as the eye consciousness has transmitted his information, then a conceptual mental consciousness can one by one look into these attributes, distinguish their outlines. So thus, here I am explaining the presentation of consciousness of that which possesses the object, which has the object.
That the Yulia Musungi Yusaro, Toka Yusaro, you understand, you did the Chachikuya, Yulia, Nung Yu, Shin Yu, Jubius.
Because there are objects of conceptual consciousnesses and non-conceptual consciousnesses, a difference has to be made with respect to those objects. One has to differentiate between the appearing object, the referent or conceived object, the object of operation, and so forth. If we take as an example the Prasangika system, and in that a consciousness, an eye consciousness apprehending a form, the the form appears. The true existence of the form appears. And the appearance of the true existence of the form appears. The eye consciousness apprehending the form is a valid cognizer of the form. And it is a valid cognizer with respect to the appearance of the true existence of the form. But it is not a valid cognizer with respect to the true with respect to the true existence of the form. From the point of view of the fact that the form is appearing to that consciousness to be truly established, the consciousness is said to be a mistaken consciousness. Though in relation to the appearance of the form as truly existent, it is a mistaken consciousness in relation to its But from the point of view in relation to its apprehending or realizing the form, it is a valid cognizer. Thus, it is both a mistaken consciousness and a valid cognizer. Thus, these two are explained in relation to these two different objects. Thus, with respect to one object, the one consciousness cannot be both a mistaken consciousness and a valid cognizer, but with respect to two objects, the one consciousness can be described as a mistaken consciousness and a valid cognizer. This is a unique tenet of the Prasangika system, which comes because they do not accept that phenomena even conventionally exist by way of their own nature. In the Swatantrika Madhyamaka system, it is said that the object of negation in the view of selflessness does not appear to a sense consciousness. But in the Prasangika system, it does. Thus, all of these consciousnesses are only mistaken with respect to the factor of the appearance of that object as if it exists in its own nature. Therefore, all consciousnesses except for the wisdom consciousness in meditative equipoise, all directly perceiving consciousnesses except for the wisdom consciousness, the exalted wisdom consciousness in meditative equipoise on emptiness are mistaken. So then if you say, then a mistaken consciousness could not be that which certifies the existence of forms and so forth, could it? If you're going to posit a truly existing object, a form, for instance, which exists in its own right, then that consciousness would have to be unmistaken with respect to the inherent existence of the object. But this is impossible. Rather, for the positing of objects which are falsities, which do not exist by way of their own nature, a consciousness which is mistaken with respect to the inherent existence of the object only helps in the process of certifying the existence of that false object. This is a very important point to help in ascertaining the view of emptiness.
Sheba shiba kanyi na ya da korang ki kato da yu ji yu tenpa yinne mene kanta nangwa ji yawarwa da na tenzin tabu lo chukarwa wakshirwa re di tenzin di tenzu na na ta ne ane tenzin yangu yawarwa so nangwa ji yu ni tenzin chumarwa tenang yu ni tenzin chumarwa so di tisongwa yinza tenang ji yuwa yinza tenang tela Dana now the day, the Utah, then you go to Samashad. Samashad, Masa, Muslim Samashad, Muslim Sama.
Any consciousness, whether right or wrong, is posited in terms of the appearance of some object. So even if you take a consciousness that is misconceiving of inherent existence, the inherent existence appears to that consciousness. Thus, that consciousness is a valid cognizer with respect to the appearance of the inherent existence of the object, even though it is a wrong consciousness.
That's all.
Then after that, a discussion of minds and mental factors. So in the division of consciousnesses into main minds and mental factors, main minds are that which distinguishes the general outline of the object, and a mental factor is that which distinguishes particular outlines of the object.
That's the number of
the various systems have different interpretations of the number of consciousnesses. There is one system that asserts only one consciousness, that is to say a mental consciousness. They give a very pretty example of this, of a monkey in a house that goes from window to window. It's only one monkey, but it's looking out this window and seeing such and such, looking out that window, seeing such and such, and so forth. So there's only one mental consciousness that operates through the various senses. So this is one extreme of too few. But then at the other extreme of too many is the position of the Chittamatrans following scripture, who posit, in addition to the six usual consciousnesses, an afflicted intellect and a mind basis of all, making eight. The root of positing this is that in order to posit the basic illustration of what the person is, they point to the mind basis of all. In any system that accepts the mind basis of all, they do not assert external objects. They say that all external phenomena appear to be externally separate entities, but are actually not so. They have a nature or are in the entity, the essence of the mind. And then in the system of Paramartha, he added on a ninth consciousness, that of the undefiled consciousness. Thus, the assertions of eight and nine consciousnesses too many. One, the extreme of too many. But that which is in the middle is the assertion six.
Oh yeah. That dilla gongle wang shi nga da yin jin nam shi jik che tu shen.
These are the five consciousnesses of the five senses and the sixth, the mental consciousness.
Yeah, ta de ne sim jung lu ya ngo bo kun du lu ngo bo kun du ne ngo su ta ngun jin na sha ba de sim jung ju zhe xie ba de.
And then with respect to mental factors as they are identified in Asanga's compendium of higher knowledge, which are explicitly identified in his text, there are
51.
So I'll talk about them this afternoon.
Now His Holiness begins Tuesday afternoon.
Question.
And have been denied a sense of self-worth, such as many women seem to benefit from gaining self-identity through therapy, support groups, and self-assertiveness training. Are such therapeutic approaches to self-validation ultimately increasing illusion and suffering, even though they seem to do the opposite? How can the need for individual integrity and power be reconciled with the spiritual principle of selflessness? This is similar to the one earlier. It meets back to the question of the fact that the self is asserted to exist conventionally. In our practice, how can we avoid the state of pride from accomplishment and depression caused by disintegration of the ego? There are two types of high sorts of consciousness. One of them is a reason type of high sort of consciousness, and really is a state of courage, and courage is definitely needed.
Now another type, you see, you feel a bit, I'd say, sort of high or proud. Actually, is that feeling based on, let's say, misconception, sorry.
Misconception.
But there is like I said.
And this is called pride.
So that then it's in your mind, yeah. Then you're trying to win,
therefore, if one really engaged in some practice and got the true imprint or result from it, it is suitable to be proud of that. For instance, in Shantideva's engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds, he speaks of three types of pride. For instance, thinking I can do something which most other people cannot do. That sort of courage. This is a case of strength of will, it's not pride. But if a bodhisattva meets with somebody, the bodhisattva takes the lower position.
Like you see in the eight verses, usually you see, many people know, you see, eight verses. This is second verses.
In there it says, no matter who one meets with, one should take the lower spot. Therefore, the mode of thinking in pride and in courageous thought is entirely different. And what do you do with depression caused by disintegration of the ego?
Tanya
this sort of depression probably comes from being unable to posit the conventionally existent I. But indeed, when you do gain some understanding of emptiness, you do then later have a different feeling about I than you had before.
It's a usual feeling that I is something like this is solid, something really independent and solid, and some very forceful feeling. You see, that no longer remain. At the same time, what is a mere I, which actually create accumulation or these things?
The accumulation of karma. This is not a source for depression, though. If however you have difficulty positing a merely nominal I and positing cause and effect within the context of mere nominality, if it gets to the point where if you assert selflessness you feel you cannot accept dependent arising, then it would be better to assert dependent arising and give up selflessness.
Selflessness
there are many different levels to be understood with respect to selflessness. Thus, because of his difficulty of positing the nominally existent I, there come to be these many different schools of tenets out of Buddhist skill and method. Because the case is that if you can't do the best, it's not that you should throw it away entirely.
That's what a lot of tabaji talk about, step by step.
You have to proceed step by step with whatever accords with your level of mind. Therefore, between emptiness and dependent arising, one should value dependent arising more highly. Yesterday you said that some objects of knowledge are not findable by analysis, for instance those for which you would need inference by belief. How can it be determined that the self for which one searches analytically is not an object that really does exist but simply is not findable by analyzing, perhaps because it is too subtle? That you said some objects of knowledge are not findable by analysis, for instance those for which you would need inference by belief. Perhaps the self is something like this that's too subtle. Yesterday we were talking about the three types of inference: inference by the power of the fact, inference through renown, and inference through belief. With regard to this, one needs to know the three types of objects of comprehension, or the three types of objects, the manifest, the slightly hidden, and the very hidden. With regard to the manifest, you don't need any reasoning.
But
for slightly hidden or slightly non-obvious phenomena, one can, in dependence upon reasoning that works on the basis of the power or the power of objects, one can put together inferences and understand those objects. For instance, emptiness is a slightly hidden object. But it seems that the self would be something that's manifest. For instance, if you say, I'm hot or I'm sick, there's some I there. And that I is manifest. In speaking about these three types of objects of comprehension, the manifest, slightly hidden, and very hidden, this is within the context of conventional valid cognizers. But when one analyzes with the reasoning distinguishing the ultimate, then just as the person or self or I is not found, so are all other phenomena not found either. Emptiness itself is not found.
So that this
has nothing to do with the fact, with the status of the object that is being analyzed, whether it is obvious, hidden, or very hidden, but has to do with the mode of analysis. One is analyzing whether the object is ultimately established or not, whether it inherently exists or not, whether it truly exists or not. Now, with regard to very hidden objects, these are objects such as the as are found in the very fine presentations of particular actions and their effects. So what kind of reasoning is used with respect to very hidden phenomena? Here one must rely on some other third factor. For instance, the people in this room are all obvious phenomena. It's not necessary to use any reasoning to realize their existence. But if you're thinking about whether there are any persons outside of the wall there, One would look for some sort of sign of there being a human there, because there couldn't be any talk outside the window unless the human were there, or the vehicles couldn't be moving on the highway unless a human were there, one pays attention to signs that indicate that a human is there.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you're wondering whether a flower is growing on the wall, on the outside of the wall there or not, however, from here, there isn't any way that we can look into that matter. So one would have to depend on somebody who had seen whether there's a flower or not. One would have to depend on the speech of that person. If you're going to rely on that person's speech, you have to look into whether that person usually lies or not, or whether the person might lie on this occasion. And having done a great deal of analysis, for instance, if the person yesterday had said there was a flower there, but today had said there wasn't, there would be a contradiction between what was said earlier and later. So one has to examine whether that person's speech can be considered to be valid or not. Similarly also with regard to a topic such as the subtle presentations of the effects of particular karmas, this is not something that we can figure out through our usual reasoning. We have to rely on some person who has experience, who knows those, who has experience with those, looking into that person's word to see if there are contradictions in what that person has explained about this topic in the early part of that person's works or in the later parts of the works, or whether there's contradiction in terms of what was explicitly said. And explicitly and implicitly? In terms of what was said earlier and before, in terms of what is said explicitly and implicitly, it has to be determined that there's no contradiction in that person's word for it to be reliable. For instance, our knowledge of our own birth date is not from our own experience, but depends upon our mother's word on that topic. I can figure out myself that I'm younger than 60 years old. For instance, you take people who are 60 years old, I know what their faces look like. I can look at my face in the mirror and see that I don't quite look like someone who's 60.
But you see, there is no possibility to know the, because of the exact date and time and month, year which I born, that I cannot, because of, I never calculate. Wholly rely on some third factors. So like that, it's similar, this is the way to know that.
This is what something that generally happens. Therefore, the fact of these three types of objects of comprehension, the obvious, which are known without depending on any reasoning, but are known in direct perception, the slightly hidden that can be known through the usual sort of reasoning, logical reasoning, at the second, and the third, the very hidden, which can only be known through a process that involves depending on someone else's word. That there are these three objects and these three types of knowing is a usual process of our lifetime. And then common. Thus, for an object that is very hidden to us and that is inaccessible to us, we can, for that object, we can rely on a scripture that speaks about that. Thus, as I was just saying, one doesn't just value scriptures highly, rather one has to analyze a great deal to see whether the scripture is reliable or not. At the expression of worship by Dignaga at the beginning of his compendium of valid cognition is commented on at length by Dharmakirti in his commentary on that text. It is concerned with how one establishes that the Buddha is a reliable or valid person. This is done through establishing that the Buddha's sayings or what the Buddha said is incontrovertible. Thus, this accords with the first reliance, not to depend on the person, but to rely on the doctrine. With respect to the scriptures, there are basically two types. Those scriptures that are concerned with means for achieving a high status within cyclic existence itself, and those texts that are concerned with attaining definite goodness, that is to say, liberation and omniscience. Dharmakirti said, because of being non-mistaken with respect to the main meaning, it can be inferred that the scriptures are non-mistaken with respect to the secondary.
Hmm.
I don't know much about Vasubandhu's treasury of knowledge.
Oh, yeah.